The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Alec Kerr. Oh, I just follow instructions. My name is Alec Kerr. I'm a former chair of the Board of Trustees of the Free Library, and I currently have the privilege of serving on the board of the foundation. Let me start with a few administrative notes and instructions. First, please, please, please take a moment now. Take out your cell phones, turn them off, put them on silence. As all of you know, there is no flash photography permitted during this event. Following the talk, there will be a book signing upstairs in the lobby. And you should also know that most of our authors' events are also offered as podcasts at freelibrary.org. As many of you know, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity. We have a wonderful slew of programs, such as this award-winning authors event. And last year, we had the privilege of putting on the American Presidency Series, which presented compelling programs during the presidential election season. As a plug, please feel free to go online to freelibrary.org/support. to make a gift that will help the library continue to make these programs available. They're transformative. And while you're online, don't forget to get your library card. And I'd like to make one other further plea. Many of you may have seen Inga Safran's wonderful article in the Inquirer this week. There are four totally renovated new library branches, Logan, Lillian Marrera, Tacony, and Lovett, that are just coming online. If you're anywhere near them, you should see what has been done to bring these libraries into the 21st century. It's truly extraordinary. They transform those neighborhoods, and it'll take your breath away. Before introducing our speaker, I also want to ask all of you to join with me in acknowledging the generosity and foresight of Mark and Toby Dichter. Toby is the current chair of the foundation, and she's done an extraordinary job in that role during the past 5 years. This lecture is made possible through their generosity in honoring Toby's mother, Melia Gordon, who was an extraordinary teacher of special education here at the Widener Memorial School. And thank you, Toby and Mark, for enabling all of us to be here tonight. I am in awe of tonight's speaker. Lawrence O'Donnell hosts The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell nightly on MSNBC at 10 p.m. He provides unique insights into the most important issues and compelling stories each day. And in an age where there's been an extraordinary dilution and diminution of respect for the truth, Mr. O'Donnell challenges us to stick to the facts. I'm not going to go through all of his curriculum vitae. It's there in your program, from his graduation from Harvard to being a writer for the West Wing, to working for Senator Moynihan in the Senate, to working for the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. He is well qualified to do what he does today. Where did he find time to write this book? And it's an extraordinary book. Playing with Fire sings to those of us who came of age during 1968. Mr. O'Donnell, I think, really writes more as a dramatist than a historian, but his book is incredibly carefully and well-researched. He weaves together the issues, the tumult, the divisions of the year, and that election, and in my view, he gets it right. You'll read about the principles. On the Republican side, Richard Nixon, George Wallace, Ronald Reagan, Nelson Rockefeller. On the Democratic side, Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, Robert Kennedy, George McGovern, and Eugene McCarthy. You'll read about the student organizers, the civil rights leaders. You'll relive the horror of the assassinations of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Senator Robert Kennedy. And you'll learn of President Nixon's perfect crime, not Watergate, but his treasonous sabotaging of the Paris peace talks at the end of President Johnson's presidency so that he could get elected. You'll also read about the Democratic Convention in Chicago. I loved this book because for at least some of these events, I was there. I worked for Eugene McCarthy for four summers as his only summer intern. I was an advance man in the campaign. I was flying from California to New York when I learned of Senator Kennedy's assassination. I spent a portion of my honeymoon at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. I was on the 15th floor of the Hilton Hotel in the aid station. And I can tell you, from what I know, Mr. O'Donnell got everything right. He and I share one truth, and in no small measure, we both owe our lives to Senator Eugene McCarthy. Senator McCarthy was quixotic, aloof, flawed, sometimes unengaged, but he was also brilliant, and most importantly, he was courageous. It was he, and he alone, who first had the courage and foresight to run for the presidency against a sitting president of his own party. As a matter of principle, it was a campaign of life and death, and it changed the course of history and the war. Had Senator McCarthy not decided to run, perhaps Mr. O'Donnell's or even my name might well have been on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington. Playing with fire may not be the last word concerning the 1968 election, but is certainly far and away the best that I've ever read. Please join me in welcoming Lawrence O'Donnell to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The one, I guess it might have been more than one, but the one funny thing I am aware of Ronald Reagan saying was before standing up before the press one day and saying, "Before I refuse to take your questions, I have an opening statement." I'm going to take your questions. I'm fascinated by your questions, you know, because I do this little show of mine alone in a room, and I have no idea what the audience feedback is, and so this is a gigantic crowd for me. There's a couple of million out there on the other side of the TV camera. I have no sense of their presence at all when I'm doing it, and so this is special to me. So I just had the most intimidating moment of this book tour backstage, which up to now has had no intimidating moments. And it was when Alec Kerr just said to me back there, I was an intern for Gene McCarthy in the Senate office, and I'm discovering this gold mine of information that should have been an interview subject for this book and isn't, because I didn't know he existed, and so I'm in terror of how this sentence is going to be finished, and he gives me the stamp of approval on all these scenes that I was not part of and had to recreate, and he could have done for me, and so that is for me by an order of magnitude indescribably the most important review I've gotten so far. The review you just heard from Alec Kerr up here tonight. So important. This is a work of history. It's a work of drama. It is a friend of mine, a Hollywood screenwriter, said to me after getting about halfway into this book, you know, your next book should be a memoir. And I said, well, Everything I write is a memoir. And that's true in ways that are less obvious in some things and more obvious in others. And I try to make that clear here, that a lot of what I'm writing about here, I was an eyewitness to when I was a high school kid sitting on the floor of the living room in our Irish Catholic neighborhood of Dorchester in Boston, watching the 1968 Democratic Convention, watching the mayor of Chicago, Richard Daley, jumping up and yelling anti-Semitic taunts to Senator Abe Ribicoff, who was on the Democratic Convention stage offering the nomination of George McGovern. And we could read his lips. We could tell what he was saying. And for those of you who couldn't read his lips, the networks had lip readers on within the hour. To tell you this horrible and despicable thing that was just screamed on the convention floor, which in and of itself would have been the single most controversial moment of any other presidential campaign year, and in this year, it was just a thing that happened on Wednesday. And not the most important thing that happened on Wednesday, because that was happening out in the streets of Chicago, outside of the hall. And so that's what drew me to this year, is this endless and chaotic stream of dramatic events, including these assassinations, the assassination of Martin Luther King, followed 2 months later by the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, each of which, in any other campaign year, would have been the biggest thing that happened in that campaign year. Martin Luther King's assassination shut down the campaign for weeks. It was followed by weeks of rioting in the streets of the United States, completely shutting down the presidential campaign. Bobby Kennedy's assassination changed everything about the presidential campaign. It looked on election night in the California primary that Bobby Kennedy might very well be on his way to Chicago to the Democratic nomination. He beat Gene McCarthy in that decisive campaign in California that each campaign believed was going to be decisive. The McCarthy campaign, the Kennedy campaign, each believed the winner of this is the only one that has a chance at the nomination. Bobby Kennedy's assassinated that night. All of these events, from the very beginning, were things that we'd never seen before. And that incredibly brave choice by Gene McCarthy to run for president in the first place, to decide at the end of 1967 to do something that he had never seen done before, which was to challenge the sitting incumbent president of his own party for the nomination for president in what's supposed to be Lyndon Johnson's triumphant reelection campaign. Lyndon Johnson's favored to be reelected after being elected the first time in a landslide in 1964. And Gene McCarthy, who had come in second in the little sweepstakes with Hubert Humphrey to be chosen as LBJ's running mate in 1964. That's how close it came. Gene McCarthy was almost LBJ's vice president. That's the person who decides to run against LBJ 4 years later on a path that we'd never seen before. We see it again in 2016. Bernie Sanders comes from out of nowhere, beginning in the polls at 3%, to take the Gene McCarthy track on the left side of the Democratic Party, the leftward insurgency against the establishment candidate, and everybody of a certain age knew they had seen this before. They knew where they had seen this before. Bernie Sanders was 27 years old, living in Vermont, when Gene McCarthy went up there and beat Lyndon Johnson in the first primary, or so I thought, because I was in high school consuming this news coverage without really reading the details, and it sure sounded like Gene McCarthy won, and this is absolutely true. It was decades later that I discovered Gene McCarthy came in second in New Hampshire, but it was such a strong second that the news media treated it as a win, and it's something I didn't know for most of my adulthood. I want to give you a sense of the eyewitness nature of this book, and by reading a passage from the beginning of the book, that where I'm beginning to try to capture what life was like in that period, which needs no description for anyone who lived through it, but it certainly does for my daughter, for whom this book is dedicated. It is a period that we haven't had since for many reasons. One of the big and challenging writing chores of this book was to try to present the 1960s somehow on these pages, and then very specifically 1968 and what it felt like in America. And so the big question for all of the presidential candidates in 1967, anyone who was thinking of running the next year, is what is Bobby going to do? Lyndon Johnson feared Bobby Kennedy running against him. Richard Nixon feared Bobby Kennedy running. He had already lost to a Kennedy. He knows how that goes. He thought Bobby Kennedy was the Democrat who could beat him. He had no plan for how you beat the Democrat if it's Bobby Kennedy. He had a plan for beating any other Democrat, including Lyndon Johnson. And the question of would Bobby run simmered for months and months and months and months, and really heated up in 1967. It really heated up. And Bobby, by this time, is a senator from New York State, and everywhere he goes around the country, the audiences start to chant, "Run, Bobby, run." And the audience experience of Bobby Kennedy on a stage in 1967 and 1968 was unlike anything that had ever been seen in American politics before, including any moment that John Kennedy ever had on a stage. Because John Kennedy was the first so-called rock star of American politics, but he didn't have an already built-in urgency about his candidacy or a built-in emotionalism about it. It was this very handsome guy with a great smile and great hair, and we hadn't really seen that on the presidential stage before. And so there was a certain kind of attention he got, but it was nothing like what Bobby Kennedy got later in the 1960s, after the Beatles had come to America, after we had seen that kind of Beatlemania reaction out there in the world. That's what the audiences were compared to for Bobby Kennedy when he went on to political stages, the reaction that the Beatles used to get. Underlying Bobby's speeches was a force we had never seen before in American politics, something we've never seen since, something Shakespearean. When Bobby stepped up to a microphone, no matter how sunny the day, no matter how wide his smile, he was always framed in tragedy, the personal and national tragedy of the assassination of his older brother, the President of the United States, on November 22, 1963, in Dallas. Bobby's audiences knew his pain because they all felt their own version of that pain on that horrendous day in 1963 that shook the country to the core. In Kennedy's hometown of Boston, it felt as if the world stopped. I was in St. Brendan's Elementary School in Boston when the nuns got the news that the president had been killed, the first Catholic president, something the older nuns never expected to see. Now they had outlived the 46-year-old Irish Catholic boy who had made them so proud. The Sisters of St. Joseph were the strongest women I knew, but this was too much for them to bear. They simply couldn't carry on. They closed school early and sent us home. We had never seen them cry before. We were all crying when the nuns got us into our lines to march us out to the sidewalk. Everyone we saw was crying. Every driver stopped at every traffic light. Men carrying tool bags were crying. Men carrying briefcases were crying. Boston cops were crying. Subway cars were filled with people crying who had left work early to go home and cry with their families and to watch the Kennedy family's ordeal unfold on TV. We watched Bobby holding his brother's widow's hand that night when she arrived back in Washington still wearing her pink bloodstained clothes. We watched him holding her hand at Arlington National Cemetery. Nothing could ever happen in this world to make us forget those images, which were only 4 years old in 1967 when Bobby's audiences started chanting, "Run, Bobby, run." And so the other candidates, possible candidates, held their breath and wondered, would he do it? Chief among them was Eugene McCarthy, who very much wanted Bobby Kennedy to run for president as the anti-war candidate and put the war on the ballot in the Democratic presidential primaries. Bobby Kennedy was approached to do that by Democrats looking for that candidate. He thought about it, decided not to do it, thought about it again, decided not to do it, Only then did Gene McCarthy start to think about it after urging those people to ask Bobby one more time. And it turns out no one really wanted to do it. Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, the most ruthless Democrat and the most ruthless Republican, feared that dream of Run, Bobby, Run. Bobby was almost certain that challenging Johnson was hopeless, but it might be the only way to put pressure on the president to de-escalate the Vietnam War. The chance, the dream, the war, and anti-war Democrats privately urging him to do it all contrived to get Bobby thinking about it. It was a rerun of the way he had approached running for the Senate 3 years earlier. At first he resisted, then he wavered, then he resisted again, then he wavered again. All the while, Johnson and Nixon and the others believed that Bobby held history in his hands. Bobby did not yet realize that the 1968 presidential election would be about nothing less than life and death. In the nuclear age, all presidential elections were, by implication at least, about life and death, because the commander-in-chief had the power to start World War III in minutes by launching nuclear missiles. But the 1968 election was going to be about the life and death of people we knew. In the spring of 1968, my cousin John T. Corley Jr. graduated from West Point, then visited us in Boston before he shipped out to Vietnam. Johnny was the tallest among us, 6'4", a West Point football star. We worried that he would be an easy target in Vietnam. Johnny wasn't worried. He grew up on Army bases with his father, a general, and was trained for combat and eager to try to rival his father's World War II and Korean War records, which filled their home with 26 awards and combat decorations, including a record-setting 8 silver stars. My oldest brother, Michael, showed Johnny his draft notice, which had just arrived in the mail. Michael was worried. He didn't want to go to Vietnam. No one we knew wanted to go, except Johnny. He wanted a career in the military, like his father, and combat was part of that. Johnny advised Michael that the best way to avoid Vietnam might be to voluntarily enlist before being drafted, because then he might get a better choice of assignments. Getting drafted was the fastest route to Vietnam. Michael took Johnny's advice, enlisted, got easy assignments in the Army, and never left the United States. Johnny arrived in Vietnam on May 9th, 1968. Over the course of that summer, his letters to Michael began to question the wisdom of the mission in Vietnam. Johnny earned a Silver Star in 4 months on September 8th, 1968, the day he was killed in action. His funeral was the first military funeral I attended. Tragedy has many faces, but none quite like a general crying, saluting his son's coffin, and it was just another day in the life of America in 1968. The presidential election could end all that if Bobby ran on ending the war in Vietnam and won, as anti-war Democrats were assuring him he could. I was in high school in 1968, and I never heard my brothers and their college-age friends talk about career planning. They only talked about how to deal with the draft and Vietnam. There was no long-term planning, no career hopes and dreams. Life was a short-term game for many young men in 1968. It was as if they were prisoners who could only begin to think about life on the outside when they got outside. Their prison was in their pocket, the draft registration card that controlled their lives and blocked their hopes and dreams. The presidential election could end all that. The presidential election was a matter of life and death for real people we all knew. That meant that this time, running for president didn't have to be about ego. It meant that running for president couldn't simply be a matter of political calculation. It meant that it wasn't just about what was best for Bobby's future in politics. It was about life and death. The death Bobby thought about was his own. He worried that announcing his candidacy might tempt an assassin. He knew assassination was driven more by madness than logic, and maybe getting the second Kennedy on his way to the presidency would capture an assassin's twisted imagination. He was the only potential candidate who had to worry about a copycat assassin going for another Kennedy. And so Bobby's thinking about running was muddled and slow. He was leaning against running most of the time. As he thought about it, Bobby, who had been the manager of his brother's winning presidential campaign, could see every detail of what could go wrong with his own. But he could not yet see what the election was going to be about, life and death. And so Bobby held history in his hands for so long that someone who could see what the election was going to be about decided he couldn't wait any longer and grabbed history out of Bobby's hands, someone no one expected to seize the moment, until he did. And that, of course, was Senator Eugene McCarthy. And as Alec can tell you, one of the provocations for running, the ultimate provocation, was something that happened to him in a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, where the Undersecretary of State said, that to the horror of Chairman Fulbright and Senator McCarthy, that declarations of war were outmoded. He believed that we no longer needed declarations of war and that the Vietnam War could continue to rage on without any further legal authority. This provoked Gene McCarthy to walk out of that hearing. He was so livid, he didn't even ask any questions. He walked out of the hearing. He said to his chief of staff, if I have, you know, we have to get this war on the ballot, and if I have to run for president to do it, then I will. And so there are an endless string of what-ifs about this election when you look back at it. What if Gene McCarthy hadn't run? Is the biggest what-if of all. There are many, many others. What if Bobby Kennedy had left the stage on the other side that night, as he was originally supposed to do, and instead of going off the stage on this side, where Sirhan was over there, in order to talk to some reporters who were waiting on the other side of the kitchen. If he had just gone off on this side, we could have had a totally different history and a totally different outcome to that campaign. There's an endless stream of these what-ifs. But the biggest what-if of all is, what if Eugene McCarthy had not run? If Gene McCarthy hadn't run, Bobby Kennedy would not have run and would not have been assassinated on the night of the California primary. President Johnson would have run for re-election. Election night would have come down to Johnson versus Nixon. No matter what the outcome, Bobby Kennedy surely would have run for president as the anti-war candidate in 1972. And then, but Gene McCarthy did run. He made the bravest decision of any candidate in 1968, a decision that changed his party, changed the campaign, changed the anti-war movement into an important faction of the Democratic Party, and changed the course of history. The most important thing Gene McCarthy did in 1968 was save lives. We have no idea when the Vietnam War would have ended if Gene McCarthy hadn't made the ending the war a presidential campaign issue in 1968. The war ended 7 years after Gene McCarthy ran. If the first anti-war presidential candidate did not run until 1972, would the war have ended 7 years later? In 1979? We don't know. The peace movement won. The peace movement drove U.S. forces out of Vietnam, not the North Vietnamese Army. American politics responds slowly to protests, so it took several years for the peace movement to win. Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger complained for the rest of their lives that they were not able to achieve what they called peace with honor in Vietnam because congressional support for the war kept dropping. That is a complaint about democracy. More and more members of Congress turned against the war because the peace movement, their voters, forced them to turn against the war. The Nixon-Ford administration would not have declared an end to the war in 1975 if the peace movement hadn't forced them to. The last man to die for a mistake would not have been killed in Vietnam on April 29, 1975. Would that man have been killed in 1976, in 77, 78, 79? How many more would have died. The millions of women and men who were active in the peace movement saved lives by forcing the war to end sooner than it would have if they hadn't taken to the streets in protest, something most of them had never done before for anything. Martin Luther King Jr. saved lives by raising his singular voice against the war. Bobby Kennedy saved lives by adding his anti-war voice to the growing chorus when it was still a politically risky choice. Al Lowenstein, Tom Hayden, John Kerry, and other leaders of the anti-war movement saved lives. Gene's wife, Abigail McCarthy, and their daughter, Mary, saved lives. There are thousands of Americans who owe their lives to the people who forced the United States to get out of Vietnam on April 30th, 1975. I received a draft notice in December 1972. I was in college. 2 weeks later, I had to report for my physical exam at an Army facility in South Boston. The place was filled with young men standing in line for their physicals. Some had doctor's letters that they hoped would disqualify them. Others were going to pretend to be gay or mentally ill to get disqualified. I passed the physical and went home to wait for my induction notice to arrive in the mail telling me exactly where to report for duty. And then, about a week before my induction notice was supposed to arrive, President Nixon ended the draft on January 27th, 1973. If Gene McCarthy had not run for president in 1968, the draft would not have ended in 1973. None of the young men I saw at the induction center that day were killed in Vietnam because the political pressure of the anti-war movement forced Nixon to end the draft. Many of the young men I saw at the induction center went on to have children and grandchildren who don't know that they owe their lives to the people who stopped the draft and the war. There are thousands of families living in Vietnam today who wouldn't be there if the war had continued for another year or two or three. The last word about Gene McCarthy should always be that no one did more to stop the killing in Vietnam than Senator Eugene McCarthy. If I have to run for president to do it, I'm going to do it. Senator Eugene McCarthy, August 17th, 1967. I want to read you one more passage and then get to questions because there are so many fascinating characters in this book. Some of them are gigantic characters in our history, like Jackie Kennedy, who was not yet Jackie Onassis at the time of the many of the events in here. And she plays some fascinatingly important roles in scenes that you otherwise wouldn't zoom in on if Jackie Kennedy wasn't in the scene. And here is just one example of this, the surprising influence and consistent influence that Jackie Kennedy had on Bobby Kennedy after the assassination. One of the most troubling events, the only troubling event, really, for Lyndon Johnson in 1964 was what happened at what was supposed to be Lyndon Johnson's convention. Lyndon Johnson was obviously president after the assassination, was now going to be nominated for his own term that he would run for, and there was no opposition. It was going to be one of these easy nominations of a sitting president. But Bobby Kennedy made an appearance at the convention. And this became the high point of the convention. It became the only moment of the convention that anyone remembers who saw any of that convention. And this drove Lyndon crazy, and this was all part of this incredible fuel of hatred and fear that Lyndon Johnson had for Bobby Kennedy, feelings that were mostly shared and returned by Bobby Kennedy to Lyndon Johnson. On the convention's last night, the Democrats showed a short film honoring JFK. Bobby was scheduled to make a short speech before the film. As he came to the podium, the hall went wild. The applause and cheering went on and on. It wouldn't stop. television commentators were speechless. No one had ever seen anything like it. Bobby didn't even try to speak. He waited, looking bashful. When he tried to speak, the applause and cheers got louder. 22 minutes. The longest ovation anyone there had ever seen. Bobby knew it wasn't for him. It was for the assassinated president who should have been there running for his second term. Bobby quoted Romeo and Juliet. When he shall die, take him and cut him out into stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. Then Bobby promised his party he was looking not only to the past, but to the future. The place exploded again. It was the most moving moment ever seen on an American political stage. It was the rawness of the emotion, the intimacy of reverential love, and Bobby's open, nearly shy reading of Shakespeare that made his speech the glory of the convention. Was LBJ the garish sun, unworthy of worship when compared to the face of heaven? Even someone less paranoid than Johnson might have taken that moment as a declaration of war. The truth of what Johnson just saw was not something he could comprehend or imagine. It was not the clever trick of a speechwriter trying to poke an opponent. No political speechwriter in 1964 would want their man invoking Juliet's blend of female passion, worship, and yearning. Adding the Juliet passage was not Bobby's idea. It was Jackie's. She had read the speech in draft and at the last minute added the passage. The grieving widow put a female voice in Bobby Kennedy's beatification of Jack Kennedy. She gave Bobby the words that would mythologize Jack and Bobby at the same time. The 1968 campaign, as I got into this research, was filled with surprises like that, and many, many more than I can recount here. I want to get to your questions as soon as we can, and I believe there are microphones ready for that are coming down the aisles, and I guess if you're, there's a hand up right there and a microphone just about right there.
I have a question, but I would be very honored to put the Matto O'Donnell ticketed nomination for the 2020 convention. And I second Judy Stillman's nomination for president.
Okay. Lyndon Johnson famously said, in words that those of us who witnessed it, even those of us in high school, in 1968, I shall not seek and will not accept. You have that memorized for life. I mean, it's in here. I mean, technically I looked it up, but I knew it from memory when the time came. I think we might be running that commercial a little too much. It's getting, but on behalf of future President Matto, I will convey your enthusiasm.
And Vice President O'Donnell.
I know how exciting this kind of evening is. This is the closest you're going to get to Rachel Maddow. I know exactly how that feels. I have a moment like that every night, you know, where I kind of try to keep her on the phone as long as I can, you know, and I'll be doing that later tonight when we do the show live. So, you know, well-known people can be, in some ways, disappointing backstage. I have the following report from backstage at MSNBC. Rachel's so much greater than you realize. I mean, the TV stuff is the tip of the iceberg of that just wonderful human being in every way. But do you have a question?
I do. I said I do have a question.
Because I can go on and on about Rachel. I've got 20 minutes on Rachel.
Whatever makes you happy. My question is not germane to the conversation that we were having about your book, but I would like to ask you, who has been your most engaging or standout interview in your career, whether it be a positive way or a negative person, a negative way shocked you or impressed you, and who have you not interviewed yet that you would like to?
Barack Obama. Would be number one on who I would like to interview, who I haven't. So I guess I have two favorites, and one of them is very recent. Favorite moments. You know, it's not... Bill Murray showed up on the show one night, unscheduled guest. He had just done the last... Well, what was the second last David Letterman show, but he was the last guest on the Letterman show, and then that final night of Letterman, there were no guests. And so Billy was doing Letterman, and I knew that he was in town doing that, which is kind of around the corner there, and that they pre-taped that. You know, that's done by 6:30 or so. And so I kind of said, well, you know, if I'm live at 10 o'clock, if you could possibly come by after that and maybe say something about Dave. And Jim Downey, who was Billy's office mate when they both started at Saturday Night Live, Jim is a writer the same year, and Jim was a college classmate of mine. Jim was the handler who was going to make sure that Bill got there. Because, you know, sometimes people's desire to do something does not match their logistical mastery of... of how to get to a building that he's been going to for 30 years. And so, and this was after dinner. So we had a regular show all booked and ready to go, and I got the word that Billy was in the building, and so Jim and Bill came kind of, you know, bumbling onto the show, and let me just stress that it was after dinner. And they're both Irish, and so they're speaking pretty softly. But it was just wonderful. It was that wonderful live TV thing that can only happen, you know, in live TV. And I kind of went into the show with a 20% likelihood that this would actually occur, and then we just kind of kept them sitting there and talking forever. And then the other thing was a scheduled guest. This was just recently, just before Thanksgiving, Nadia from Pussy Riot in Moscow, the bravest protester I know today. We got in touch with each other many, many months ago and kind of worked out this date. I think it was December 3rd, as I recall, or somewhere around there, that Friday night, that she would come and be able to do this. And I learned something extraordinary from her about this book. She did not know that I had written a book about 1968, and spontaneously in our interview, she mentioned... And Nadia, I think, is 29, and 28 maybe. And she mentioned 1968 in America and how inspiring that is and remains for Russian protesters now, the Russian resistance to the Putin regime. And she knew all about it. She knew an amazing amount of detail about it that I talked to her about after the show. And so I was thrilled to discover that 1968 lives and lives in the streets of Moscow now. And you know, this is the bravery in her case. I didn't realize this until we met. She's a mother of a 9-year-old. And her daughter was 4 when she went to prison for 2 years. And it ended up being 2 years. The sentence was for much longer. They had no idea when they were going to get out. And luckily, there was enough public pressure coming from media like ours that at that time, Putin responded to, and she got out. But that to me, was that's just an incomparable moment, and including just the thrill of discovery of what the importance of the American protest movement means for the way others model themselves on it around the world. She has that kind of bravery that she's unaware of, that there's a certain confusion that comes across her when you ask her about how worried was she about getting arrested and being sent to prison. She doesn't quite get the question, and that's just a level of bravery that I, you know, don't find easily accessible in our lives now in this country. So those are the two high points. There's a question right down there. Is the microphone somewhere? There's a microphone.
So 50 years ago, Eugene McCarthy stood up when he was needed. The Democratic Party seems to be adrift in terms of leadership right now. You see any standard bearer coming up and carry the party?
I don't know who the next Democratic presidential nominee is going to be, but parties that are out of power, parties that are in the minority in the House and the Senate and not in the White House, always look this way. And because there's this craving in the American organizational mind for the leader, and it's always hard to identify who is the leader of a party when that party doesn't have the White House. The organizational chart just isn't obvious. But the history of our politics tells us that that is completely irrelevant to the way the next election will unfold. And, you know, I think that more of them are going to run than we've seen before, actually. Certainly more than last time, where it was really effectively only two, a couple more at the very beginning, but there are really only two real candidacies. And there's two reasons, there's two models, there's two things to run for. One is the Obama job, the other is the Biden job. And you will notice that the Democrats have this tendency to choose their vice presidential nominee from the field of competitors. You know, Joe Biden and then John Edwards before that. And there's plenty of reason for that, you know, because there's a fair amount of testing that goes on in that campaign. There's a fair amount of name recognition that gets built. And then also there's a certain following that you then merge, you know, into that candidacy. So, you know, I frequently look at candidates and go, oh, he's running for vice president. You know, he's running for vice president. And they tend to be pretty obvious which ones are doing that. And Lindsey Graham was running for Jeb Bush's vice president. It just didn't work out. So I don't know. I'm very patient about that stuff. I'm always happy to wait and see how it unfolds. There's one over here.
I guess we're about the same age, and I recall my draft experience, and now we have a professional army and we have no draft. How about some comment about the pluses and minuses of the draft and creating protests for any adventures, military adventures?
Yeah, well, so it turns out those of us who felt oppressed and imprisoned under the regime of the draft can now fairly see that it was, in its way, the most important tool in ending the war in Vietnam. The protest movement was animated by the fear that your brother could get drafted and killed in Vietnam, or your boyfriend, or your uncle, or your cousin. It didn't have to be you. It didn't have to be in your immediate family. It was next door. It was everywhere. And so the draft made that feeling universal, which is why Nixon ended the draft. He understood what a generator of protest the draft was. And the Army, on its end of it, wasn't especially fond of the draft once the Vietnam War became unwieldy. They had tremendous discipline problems, and they began to think, you know, maybe we should only have the people here who want to be here. And, you know, I don't think you'd be able to mount a Vietnam War and get troop levels up to 50,000 and have, 16,000 killed in 1 year alone. In 1968, I don't think you'd be allowed to do that democratically, even with an all-volunteer army. And just for scale, just for numbers scale, 1968, 16,589 families have the kind of funeral that my cousin Johnny had in 1968. We were one of 16,589 families in the United States. In the entire 21st century of military activities in Afghanistan and Iraq, in the entire 16 years, we are now up to, both countries combined, 6,883. That's not even 6 months of 1968. Not even 6 months of 1968. And so the all-volunteer army has changed the dynamics and the urgency of war protest. It certainly has changed the vulnerability. You now can have a Congress where virtually no members of Congress have family members who are exposed to the possibility of death in combat, and that certainly changes the approach that Congress has to it. So it's one of the reasons that Charlie Rangel, a former congressman representing Harlem for half of a lifetime in Congress, used to say that he was in favor of a draft. He was in favor of bringing the draft back for this reason, to get people more invested in our war policy and invested in it pro and con. And his belief was this point, that nothing could put the brakes on our war policy better than a draft.
To follow that with sort of a bend to it, there was a sense of order still in 1968. People protested, but there were limits to what society would tolerate. And part of that was there was a draft and there were systems. What do you think in the disordered society of 2016, 17, 18, what would happen if there were that size of protest? If there were a women's march in January that had a single contest, is there anybody who's willing to run for president given the risks that go with that?
You know, I think that 2016 and 2017 are very, very calm, orderly times compared to 67, 68, and 69, 70, as that war went on. And, you know, as big as the protest movement was in 1968, when Nixon was reelected, for example, in 1972, he's inaugurated in 1973, January of 1973. That is when we got the second, only the second inauguration protest in history. Second. And it was 100,000 people. The first was Nixon's first inauguration 4 years earlier, which was 10,000 people. 10,000 people in Washington, D.C., protesting against the continuation of the war machine, as they would put it. 4 years later, it's worse, it's 100,000. And, you know, I knew that number because of researching this book. And then the Trump inauguration was approaching. And I started to hear from people, women in Los Angeles, who I know are afraid of flying and who can't book a hotel room in Washington, who are going to Washington anyway. And they're asking me, do I know someone whose sofa they can sleep on? And I'm getting those calls. And I start to think, which I never like to do from anecdotal information, this could be big. And so at 11 a.m., and so I do something that I'm not known for at MSNBC. I volunteer for extra duty. I volunteer to go in Saturday morning and hang with Joy Reid at, say, 11 a.m., because I know the protest, the inauguration, the women's inauguration protest march will be underway, well underway by 11 a.m., and I might have a few things to say about it. So by the time I get on at 11 a.m. and I see the numbers in Boston, and I see the numbers that they know about in New York, I see the numbers they know about in Washington, I get to tell the world, which had absolutely no statistical comparative notion of this until I brought it up, that this is already, just in the city of Boston alone, the largest inauguration protest in history, just in Boston. And then, you know, we go on, and it's millions in the United States, and it's the biggest protest in the history of Los Angeles. In the history, which for those of you who know the town, it's not a protest town. It doesn't have kind of logical gathering places the way other towns do. And so we have just seen the single biggest one-day protest in the history of the world. And it was about Donald Trump. It was about resistance to this president. And so I, in historical terms, am both in awe of and somewhat not surprised by the enormity of this resistance, which now expresses itself in the polls. And the reason you don't see it happening on a much more frequent basis, the way it was during the war, is that there is, for this literally simple reason, there is not a Vietnam War to stop now. There is just this constant and existential worry, is what is the madman going to do if he wakes up in the middle of the night? And you don't know. So you don't know, which sign should I run out there with, you know, tonight? So in Vietnam, there was this very precise, concentrated thing, and the protest movement knew that every day counts, and every time they can mount a protest, wherever they can mount it, counts, and that they are, I don't think they were conscious of the fact that what they were doing was chopping off the number of days that there would be at the end of this war. That what they were doing was chopping off the time of this war so that April 29th, 1975 was going to come. And that's when that war was going to end. It's the lack of that specific protest target in the world of Trump that has changed the frequency of this. But the uprising we saw the day after that inauguration was the single biggest protest, not just in the United States of America, the single biggest one worldwide on one subject ever. And that's a real force to be reckoned with. This is, I'm told, the last question. See, this show, it's live at 10 o'clock. So if I were to get there at 10:05, that would be a test of Rachel's love, unlike anything else I've ever forced her to confront.
What's it called? It's not one man, one vote. We have the Electoral College in favor of doing away with it.
We have the opposite of that. Yeah, you know, I've been an election observer a couple of times, and I think the most recent one I did was in Azerbaijan many years ago. And it's so fascinating when you go to those countries, these new democracies, they're new at voting, these former Soviet satellites, you know, that were finally getting to vote. And, you know, the things you'd look at, like how secure is that plastic kind of industrial strength barrel that these votes are going into, and is it impossible to pull them back out, and, you know, all that stuff. And all that stuff, you know, passes your test. But when you stare at it, you realize that a really determined person could, when no one's looking, get that thing open and maybe get some ballots out of there, and we wouldn't necessarily be able to tell that if they were able to reseal it the right way. But, you know, you develop a certain, you know, acceptable level of satisfaction with what you've been able to witness. And so then you write a report, there's a group report written, and it doesn't claim these, you know, you never claim this was an absolutely fair election. You simply claim we did not witness any tampering with, and you do all that, right? And they scheduled the election. The election was scheduled well in advance. They did everything right about letting the country know that there was an election, which is kind of mandatory for a fair election. And then we write those reports and we say, it looked pretty good. And then we fly out of the country. If we wrote one of those reports and we're handing it in and we're grabbing our bags to go to the airport and someone says to us, yeah, and in a couple of months, some other guys are going to meet. You don't know their names. And in this place, and they'll decide. We go, well, we can't. We got to take that report back. We can't certify that. That's not democracy. That is an outrage. That is a crime against democracy. And, you know, Hamilton was one of the co-authors of the Electoral College concept, and he soured on it very quickly, very, very quickly, because he started to see it abused even then. What they wanted was the wise men, because it could only be men, right? The wise men would, the electors, would get together. Because remember, to a certain extent, this was their expression of how much they don't trust democracy. You know, they're interested in it, but they don't trust it that much. The wise men would get together and make their best choice of who should be president. And these electors were completely free to vote for anyone they wanted to. They are constitutionally free to vote for anyone they want to. And so that's what Hamilton was hoping they would do. And he started to see that, as he would call it, faction was developing, what they would later call parties. And that was making him very nervous. And he actually did a rewrite of the Electoral College that he then never was able to push forward. There's a solution to it that's on the horizon. You can never do a constitutional amendment for a million reasons now. This country will never be the place that can do another constitutional amendment about anything, because the level of agreement you need is way too big. And look, there are losers if you do that. You know, the South Dakota vote, the South Dakota voter, whose vote is worth 10 times the California voter, is not going to like any adjustment to this. And so what's out there is this agreement among states that says our state will vote for, our electors will vote for whoever wins the national vote. I never call it the popular vote. You know why? Because there's no other country in the world that calls it the popular vote. They call it the vote. Okay, so I don't like this. Once you're saying popular vote, you're accepting this notion that it's this thing, you know, that is separate from, you know, the vote. And so that bill, which California and other states have already passed, it activates once you get a number of states to agree to it that equal 270 electoral votes. And they are, you know, I don't know, a few states away from getting there, but in that kind of thing, the last few states are always the hardest to get to. If they get to that, then the Electoral College becomes muted and it has no effect. And at that point, presidential campaigning changes. It changes completely. And you start going for votes instead of electors. And you don't have to worry about, are there 10,000 people, you know, just inside the border of Michigan who are mad at me for something I said last week? You can just, you know, try to find 10,000 more people in California, you know, who like something you say this week. And so that's the hope of getting out of it. And you know, one of the reasons there hasn't been any pressure on it is we didn't see until 2000 that this was even possible. It was a game. It was like the idea of, you know, someone who doesn't win the vote but wins the Electoral College was like a game that insiders would play with each other. Like, what if the election ended up in the House of Representatives because no one won the Electoral College? You know, it was a game, and then it became the real thing in 2000. And then, absurdly, you know, 16 years later, the same thing happened again. And at that point, you've got a pattern. That's not an accident anymore. That's a pattern. You know, if we thought it wasn't going to happen for another 100 years, you know, we could relax. But there's nothing to relax about in that. And it is the most anti-democratic electoral operation in what is considered the democratic world. There is nothing like it anywhere else in the world for very, very good reason. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.